Fat bottom girls, you make the rockin' world go round.
Brian May and Roger Taylor return in the studio for the conclusion of Queen's 5th anniversary.
We sat down that night very late, maybe 2 in the morning, and watched in video machines were just invented then, of the Marx Brothers, A Night at the Opera. Freddie and I turned around to each other, remember, and said, "Cool, that's a good title," because we'd just been doing this mock operetta.
He could already see how it would be if we played it in a concert and everyone had their hands in the air were saying, "We are the champions." And I could see that was what it was about. And I think years later we talked about it and he said to me, he said, "Rock and roll is the only place where everybody has a feeling of like being in a team, but you're not fighting anybody."
Yes, I always thought there was an instant when we were the biggest thing in the world. There was about 3 seconds where we were the biggest group in the world. You know, but Another One Bites the Dust sort of clinched it because it suddenly crossed over to the R&B market, and suddenly, instead of 1 million albums, we were 3 or 4 million albums or whatever it was. Play the game. This is Brian May.
Hi, and I'm Roger Taylor. We're from Queen.
And we're in the studio with Redbeard, of course.
With over 300 million recordings sold in a regal career, it's hard to recall or imagine a time when Queen was not one of the most popular bands in the world. Yet in our In the Studio rockumentary on their breakthrough 1975 album, A Night at the Opera, Queen guitarist-songwriter Brian May reminded us that he and his bandmates John Deacon on bass, Roger Taylor on drums, and singer Freddie Mercury had only one mid-chart hit after 3 full albums, and Queen was perilously close to being dropped from their record label if A Night at the Opera didn't take off. Here's Queen's Brian May and Roger Taylor with me in the studio.
Yeah, it was sort of life or death. I mean, it was definitely sink or swim. If that album hadn't done what it did, that would have been the end of the band without any question.
It's easy to gamble when you've got nothing to lose.
That's right. It was just like, you know, we have to do what we do, and if we die, then we die by our own mistakes and no one else's.
that's all right.
Tie your mother down,
yeah, yeah.
Tie your mother down,
or you ain't no friend of mine.
Less continued their dazzling variety of musical styles on the 1976 follow-up album, A Day at the Races. But rock was going through a convulsive punk purge by 1977, and Brian May told me that Queen wanted to do something to reflect that with their next album, News of the World.
English traditional recording at that time was everybody has to be sealed off from everyone else. You know, the guitar has to be in this little cubicle, the drums have to be hidden away in this place which is totally deadened, you know, and there's no way that anything shall meet except when it gets on the tape. And I thought it would be fun to do it opposite and just set up all in the studio so we can all see each other and hear each other and play. So you wouldn't be able to change anything, but you would get the live feel. And Mike Stone was engineering, and he was very into it and thought, yeah, why don't we do this? Because that's obviously what people did in the old days, and it used to work. Why doesn't it work now? So we did it one day, set up just, you know, within about a 5-foot radius of each other and played the thing. And I didn't have the song complete at the time. We had just a verse and a chorus, and I said, just try it like this, having played it over to them. And Mike, luckily, had the tape rolling. And the first time we played it through, it had a certain sort of feel. We went and listened to it into the control room, and it sounded great. And we thought, that's exact. I mean, we all loved it and thought it sounded natural and had a nice feel to it, and the sounds were warm. And you could feel that everything was in the same room, you know.
Anybody find me somebody to
stand on my feet.
Take a look in the mirror and cry.
Lord, what you doing to me? I have spent all my years in believing you, but I just can't get no relief. Lord, somebody, can anybody find me? Day of my life, I work till I ache my bones. At the end
of the day,
I take home my heart on me.
All of my own
is tired out. My knees and eyes spread away till the tears run down from my eyes.
Lord,
somebody,
please,
can anybody
find
Said that was going to be the quick one, because A Night at the Opera and A Day at the Races had been so complex and so layered that we said we want to just do a quick one and see what comes out, you know, something which is very straightforward. And it's strange, a lot of people said afterwards, you know, oh, you're kind of following the punk trend or whatever, you know, but actually it was, that was in our minds before any of that happened, and it was going along alongside that. And doing I remember doing We Will Rock You and all that sort of stuff in Wessex Studios in North London. And the Sex Pistols were being tried out in the studio next door. And the guy was saying, I can't record these guys, they can't play, you know, it's a waste of time. And I remember Fred meeting Sid Vicious, you know, and he said, are you Simon Awful or something, instead of Sid Vicious. My Fred couldn't remember what his name was. And he said, yeah, something like that. I can't remember the exact details. But we were already doing, for some reason, it just had hit us that way. We were already doing stuff which was very sort of sparse and minimal, and a sort of rejection of the fussiness which we'd got into in A Night at the Opera and A Day at the Races. That's not to say I don't like those albums, I do. But at that time, we thought it was good to try the other way. So News of the World was really, get back in there, let's play, and do something which is raw and recaptures some of perhaps that first album sort of instant magic, you know.
Buddy, you're a boy, make a big noise, playing in the street, gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace, kicking your can all over the place. singing,
we will, we will rock you. We will, we will rock you.
Buddy, you're a young man, hard man, shouting in the street, gonna take on the world someday. You got blood on your face, a big disgrace, waving your banner all over the place.
We will, we will rock you.
Sing it!
We will, we will rock you.
Buddy, you're an old man, poor man, pleading with your eyes, gonna make you zombie someday. You got mud on your face, big disgrace, somebody better put your bag into your place.
We will, we will rock you.
Sing it!
We will, we will rock you.
Everybody,
we will, we will rock you. We will, we will rock you.
All right.
We Will Rock You and We Are the Champions both come from the newly remastered and expanded deluxe edition of Queen's 1977 album News of the World. Brian May told me how he wrote We Will Rock You.
Generally, if an idea comes, just put it down in the simplest form, like on a little Walkman-type tape recorder I used to carry around. So I think I just sang it into a tape recorder. At that time, you know what it needs. You know, you can hear the whole thing in your head. It's just a question of actually putting it on tape, making it happen. So I could just hear... I just wanted some... To tell you the truth, I blundered. I'll tell you that. I don't usually tell people this. But I thought... You know, I'd seen people in football matches and all that kind of stuff, doing stuff, you know, clapping and chanting and stuff. And I thought it would be the easiest thing in the world for people to go bump, bump with the foot and with the hands, right? So I thought, well, that's easy. People can do that and they'll enjoy doing that. And then they can sing this chant along with them, you know. But actually, as far as I can tell, although it's still used by football clubs and all kinds of teams all throughout the world, which makes me very proud and very happy, I think the way it's done normally is all clapping and no feet. And that's probably because they're standing on concrete and the feet don't make much noise. But I noticed that in the concerts, if people did it, which they did after a while, they would go clap, 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 instead of bump, bump, crack, you know. And it's only people like the, you know, New Kids on the Block who get it right.
I've paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence but committed no crime. And bad mistakes I've made a few. I've had my shouts and kicks in my face, but I've come through.
And I need to go on.
Consider it a challenge before the whole human race, and I ain't gonna lose.
And I need to go on, 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 on.
Brian May admits that he wasn't too thrilled the first time that he heard the amazing song We Are the Champions.
It was one of those nights where I'd been working since 6 o'clock in the morning or whatever and got tired and went home, and the others put down a demo, which always pisses me off a great deal because I hate being out of the room when something's being done. So I think I got back to the studios the next morning and they played me this thing and I went, ah, that's really very nice. Actually feeling very jealous, you know, and thinking, I wish I'd been on that, you know. And they had really a basic track down by that time, I think. And I was kind of quite shocked because I thought, nah, come on, Fred. I thought, you know, we know you're very egotistical and everything, you know, and we're known for our arrogance, but are we really going to stand up and say we are the champions as opposed to every other group and every other person on the face of this earth, you know? And he said, actually, that's not what it is. And I don't think he said any more than that. And then I just thought about it and I thought, well, actually, maybe I was a little bit hasty, you know, because he could already see how it would be if we played it in a concert and everyone had their hands in the air were saying, we are the champions. And I could see that was what it was about. And I think years later we talked about it. And he said to me, he said, rock and roll is the only place where everybody has a feeling of like being in a team, but you're not fighting anybody. You know, it's like if you're at a game, you have two sides who are singing their songs and feeling very much part of a team, but they want to kill the other side. The difference at a rock concert is everybody's in the same team.
Sammy was low, just watching the show over and over again. Knew it was time, he'd made up his mind to leave his dead life behind. His boss said to him, you'd better begin to get those crazy notions.
Next, we'll hear an example of the majestic capabilities of Queen live in concert in the late 1970s. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and visit us for more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Brian May and Roger Taylor for Queen's Fanniversary Part 2.
This is Brian May.
Hi, and I'm Roger Taylor. We're from Queen.
And we're in the studio with Redbeard, of course.
Thank you, gentlemen. We're exploring the Royal Rock of Queen's Deluxe Expanded Catalog. I'll never forget seeing Queen in concert from Fifth Row Center in fall 1978 in Memphis, Tennessee. Truly one of the best live shows I had ever seen. Queen guitarist Brian May recalls that late 70s period.
We were on a roll, you know, we were just buzzing and we couldn't stop. It was great, you know, everything we did was a little bit better than the thing before and a bit bigger. And we thought, this is the way life is always going to be, you know, we're always going to come back the next year to Chicago and we're going to play to twice as many people as we did last year and, you know, so on and so forth. It was like, let's see how far we can take this thing. We were very excited. It was just like we'd hit our dream. We'd found out that we could tour, we could make albums that excited people, and it was all coming together. And I think the two worked together brilliantly at that time. You know, everything that we did on the album, we were half thinking about what was going to happen on tour, and vice versa. We would do things on tour which would work one night, and we think, that goes on the next album. You know, we were very free in our approach, and really drinking in what the audience were doing, because that was a big development at that time. I remember at that time that we would tour places and people would be singing along with us, you know, which was a great feeling. You know, it's just like you get very emotional at those points. And we thought, God, there's a whole sort of well there that which needs to be tapped. People come to a concert because they want to drink in what they see, but they also want to participate. They have a lot to give out. And we thought how wonderful it would be to kind of design the act and the songs and the sound and the lights so that people could feel that they did interact a bit more. So that's why We Will Rock You came about, so that people could stamp and clap and sing. That's why We Are the Champions came about, because that was meant to be something that people would sing along and say, we are the champions, that sort of feeling like we all together are the champions. That's how they came about, particularly those two songs, which are the sort of anthems of that album.
Oh, you're gonna take me home tonight. Oh, down beside that red firelight. Oh, you're gonna let it all hang out. Fat bottom girls, you make the rocking world go round.
Won't you take me home tonight? Oh, down beside your
So we got into, you could say in a nutshell, we got into audience participation at that point.
Yes, God love them. Fat Bottom Girls comes from the 1978 Queen Deluxe Edition of Jazz. Queen drummer Roger Taylor remembers this period when Queen toured constantly, stopping only to record another album.
It was an exhausting time. It was an exhausting time. I remember, I think we actually sort of really almost burned out. You know, it was almost overwork, but it was great to look back on it, you know. But I think our creative flow suffered a little over that period. Of course, we were working so hard, but, you know.
I think at times we were a bit inefficient. I can remember labouring over that Live Killers album and mixing it ourselves, and we recorded countless concerts.
Yeah.
And we insisted on going through every performance and listening to them all and picking them all up. I think we should have just said to someone, hey, mix us a live album.
It would absolutely have been much easier. And I don't think it actually turned out.
It wasn't that great
anywhere
in the end,
near as well as it could have done. No, to
that's right. Yeah.
Obrigado.
Thank you.
Love of My Life from June 1979. It's a bonus track on the deluxe edition of A Night at the Opera, spotlighting the imperial talent of Queen singer-songwriter Freddie Mercury. Next up, Brian May and Roger Taylor invite you to play the game. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear a lot more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio for the Queen Anniversary Deluxe Editions, Part 2.
This is Brian May.
Hi, and I'm Roger Taylor. We're from Queen.
And we're in the studio with Redbeard, of course.
And this is The Game.
The Game had an overall sparse and rhythmic sound compared to previous Queen albums. And Brian May said the change was a conscious one.
It's unusual for us to actually put a direction into the albums. It usually just happens naturally. But we did try and put this in, yeah. We thought it's time that we did a bit of rhythmic stuff and left a few more open spaces, which is what we've done, really. Usually our stuff is very heavily layered. A lot of counterpoint and a lot of background harmonies and all kinds of stuff. But this one is pretty open most of the time. You have two or three instruments going at one time and that's all, which makes a big difference. The first day of the studio, we sit and play each other what we have and talk about directions we could take. And maybe we'll play around with them and see what can be done as far as instrumentation. And then the one person who wrote the song will generally go away and complete it, and complete the arrangement, and bring it back, and we all start playing it then. It changes a little bit after that again, during the overdub stage and everything, if there are any overdubs on it. But always it's the composer who has the last say, and he writes the words and the final version of the melody. And he generally, the composer does the mix as well.
Listen.
Great swinging song, Crazy Little Thing Called Love, from Queen, came out 6 months before the rest of the album, according to Brian May and Roger Taylor of Queen.
We recorded that song really 6 months before the rest of the album. And I remember while we were actually in the studio in Munich in Germany doing the rest of that album, that song had already been released. And we were there and I remember somebody phoning up and saying, hey, your record's just gone to number 2 in America. And we all went out and had a celebration. Wow, great. And then the next week we got the phone call again, hey, the record's number 1 in America. And And it seemed unreal because we were on the other side of the world and we hadn't even finished the album, which this single was from. We were still working on it. So we thought, oh, we're off to a good start here, you know.
I don't think I was even there.
I don't think you were.
I was out of the room. See, yeah. It always happens. If I go out for a couple of hours, they create something.
See, we come up with a winner.
Yeah, I came back and they'd already put down the backing track. And Roger just had the live drums. Freddie had played acoustic guitar. Because that rhythm on there is Freddie. I don't think I played any of that.
Yeah, it is. Rhythm. It's Freddie on the acoustic. And it took half an hour to record. It was like that. Yeah, it just came down. It had a great feel.
Yeah, it's like
I remember he came in the studio. He says, "My dear, I just wrote this in the bath," and he did. He'd just been lying in the bath. He had this thing. The chords would go like that, and I call it "Crazy Little Thing Called Love," and there it was. And it was very simple, very easy, and it had a great fresh sound to it. And I think Brian did a really nice Telecaster solo on that, which all fitted in great with that slight rockabilly. Kind of edge, you know. We wanted it like almost a slightly early Elvis feel, you know. That was the idea. I mean, that's not easy to get.
Yeah, it's good. That was a good thing for Mac, who became our engineer for those couple of albums and producer. Well, co-producer, because I guess we're always the producers, really. He was good, Mac, actually. I mean, he brought out some things. We were a bit set in our ways by that time, I think. We thought there was one way of doing things. Yeah. And Mac said he's a very dry German, you know, but he sounds English because he'd worked with Jeff Lynne for years, so he had a kind of Birmingham come German accent. He sounded more English than anything else, and he would say, I mean, talking about the guitar, you know, I said, well, I can make my guitar sound like a Telecaster, like those old rock and roll records. And he said, if you wanted to sound like a Telecaster, play a Telecaster, you know. So he did. He got me to do it, which is unusual. That's one of the few times I've ever played a solo on something that wasn't my regular guitar, and it did work very well. I used Roger's Telecaster, one of his collection, because Roger collects extremely rare guitars. So I used one of those, and it just worked out. Sounded fine.
Crazy Little Thing Called Love was not only unlike any Queen song previously, it presaged a rockabilly revival at the time.
There was a movement which we didn't know anything about in America at that time to sort of revive rockabilly, and it happened soon after Crazy Little Thing. So soon after that, people were saying, oh, of course, you pioneered this resurgence of rockabilly, and we were saying, well, actually, we don't know anything about it. We just made a track that we liked.
That's right. I remember actually one of the things which made me very proud was that John Lennon said in a Rolling Stone or some article, he said something like, oh, I heard a Queen record, and it's obviously that's where he comes from, you know, early rock and roll roots. He said, and it made me want to get back in the studio. And I thought, wow, fantastic.
That's great. You know,
to have actually had any little dent on the life of somebody like Lennon was great.
Some of the biggest sonic improvements are evident on the newly remastered deluxe edition of Queen's 1980 blockbuster album, The Game. Revered among other guitarists, Brian May is almost criminally under-recognized by the general rock audience. Yet Queen drummer Roger Taylor told me that Brian's extraordinary guitar skills were obvious to Roger from the beginning.
Actually, that's strange. That the first time I heard Brian play ever, I remember, I was very particularly impressed with the sort of touch and tone, which was a sort of had a musicality I hadn't heard before. Mm-hmm. Touch is part of the sort of tone, isn't it? It's a sort of vibrato thing. It's very, very musical, very melodic style of playing Brian has, I think.
It's funny that my recollection is the same of Roger, really. First seeing him tune up his snare. I'd never seen anybody tune a drum before. The drummers I knew just sort of played it the way it came from the shop, I think. So Roger was doing these very very musical rolls on the snare, you know, just before he touched anything else. And I remember thinking, that's, you know, I hadn't heard that kind of thing before. It's strange, we both had the same memories of that. Yes, I think as a band, we're very aware of sound. You know, you can make great, wonderful records, you know, and build in all sorts of arrangements and everything. But if it doesn't sound nice, nobody wants to listen to it. I think it's something which isn't talked about very much these days. You know, the sound quality is vital.
Let's go! He walks slowly down the street with the brim pulled way down low. Ain't no sound but the sound of his feet. Machine guns ready to go. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat? Out of the doorway, the bullets rip to the sound of the beat, another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. And another one gone, and another one gone. Another one bites the dust, hey. Hey, I'm gonna get you too. Another one bites the dust.
John Deacon composition, Another One Bites the Dust, expanded Queen's musical empire into realms not previously associated with rock music. Here are Brian May and Roger Taylor.
We wrote very separately in those days.
Yeah.
And, you know, we never really talked about what the songs meant as well. I think we were quite shy about what we were trying to say individually in the songs. We tend to talk about things more now.
Yeah, very much more now.
That's
so
right.
We'd be playing on a record and we had no idea that, you know, what it meant.
That's right.
It started off so well. Said we made a perfect pair. I clothed myself in your glory and your love. How I loved you, how I cried. Years of care and loyalty were nothing but a shame.
Queen guitarist Brian May talks about the song Save Me from The Game.
I wrote it about a friend, someone who was going through a bad time, and I imagined myself in their shoes kind of telling the story. That's what it is, you know, someone whose relationship has totally f***ed up and you know, how sad that person was. I don't suppose you can print that.
I don't This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my guests Roger Taylor and Brian May. For interviews and exclusive live performances by the biggest names in rock, visit inthestudio.net. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Barbarossa Limited Productions. Copyright 2011, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunette. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Be a part of the In the Studio network at inthestudio.net.